Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Native New Yorkers may claim they know the city like the back of their hand, but chances are they don't know New York like our next guest does. Matt Green is a former civil engineer turned full-time walker who in 2010 completed a journey across the U.S. on foot and still couldn't get rid of the itch to keep walking. So in 2011, Matt decided to walk every single street, park, graveyard, alleyway, you name it, in the five boroughs of New York, a journey just over 8,000 miles. Though he began the walk alone, in 2014, Matt was joined by Jeremy Workman. The resulting documentary, titled The World Before Your Feet, was produced by actor Jesse Eisenberg, now producer Jesse Eisenberg, and shows the city like you've never seen it before.
For me, there's a big difference between reading about a place in a book and being there in person. What it feels to stand in front of it, to touch it, to discover something about it. All of a sudden, it comes alive to me.
How you doing?
Oh, hi! What are you doing?
I'm doing this big walking project. Walking every block of the five boroughs.
So it's like a mission?
Yeah, it's a mission.
Aren't you tired?
I'm a little tired.
The film premieres on Wednesday, November 21st at the Quad, and Matt, Jeremy, and Jesse will be conducting Q&As at the theater from Wednesday through the weekend, and all three of you guys are in studio. Welcome to All of It.
Howdy.
Thanks for having us.
So, Matt, we're going to start with you. How did you prepare for this walk? What did you do prepare sort of physically and practically, and then what did you prepare in your head?
I didn't prepare much, I don't think. I don't know how to train for, 8,000 mile walk other than to maybe walk 2,000 miles. So I figured I'll just get the training in as I go. I didn't have any particular agenda with it. I'm not looking for anything in particular. It was just kind of go out there and see what happens and see what I respond to and what catches my eye. And so really it was just a matter of trying to just be open and, be wherever I was at the moment and see what was there.
How much did you know about New York City before you started?
I had done a lot of long walks around New York. I'd started this walking group back in my engineering days, and we'd go out on a weekend and like walk 20 miles or something in different neighborhoods. So I just started learning little bits and pieces of things. And what that really taught me was that you can basically just pick any route through any part of New York, and it's going to be a really interesting walk. Like when I first started, I thought I had to jam-pack these walks full of exciting things so people wouldn't get bored who were walking with me. But I started to realize over time that you don't even have to try.
One of the things you make very clear in the beginning part of the film is that you're not doing this for any monetary reason. You don't have a book deal. Mm. You didn't have a camera crew initially following you. So really, when you think about it, what was your goal?
I didn't know what my goal was. And that was part of my goal, I guess, was to try to do this thing that had no goal and to just, just follow what felt like I should do and see what happened. Because I think there's this kind of disconnect between the real reason that we do things and the way that we explain them to people. And a lot of times I don't think we're fully in touch with why it is we want to do something. We just come up with a nice, tidy way to say it to people. So I was kind of interested in doing this thing that I really didn't have an explanation for and not trying to come up with one.
Sounds like meditation, what you just described. You're supposed to clear your brain of everything and just do or just be in the moment.
Yeah, I if you had said that to me at the beginning, I would have probably rolled my eyes and thought, like, oh, this sounds so ridiculous. But over time, I think I would agree with you. And I've actually met some people who do this really long running kind of meditation. And I've started to see that you're absolutely right about that, even though I didn't anticipate it at the beginning.
Jeremy, let's bring you in. Mm-hmm. How did you come across this story?
Well, I had known Matt for several years, a good few years before he even started the walk. As you said, he walked across country, and I was friends with him then. We were good friends. So when he started the New York City walk, I was fascinated. And Matt has a blog. He has a website, imjustwalkin.com. It's not very popular. you know, somebody even in the movie. Yeah, I mean, you know, bluntly.
The world's saddest close-up of one comment.
I know. In the movie, somebody even comments that, you know, like 10 people go a day or whatnot, and there's shots in the movie where you see, you know, one comment, no comment. It's sad. But I was one of the, you know, the 10 people that would go to the website, and just because I knew Matt, and I was constantly fascinated by what I saw. And it was a look at New York City that I had, you know, I'd lived here for years and years. I had never seen the city in this way. I'd never really seen the boroughs this way. Matt goes to all streets, you know, and it's really, there's thousands, and the neighborhoods, there's hundreds. And it just seemed this view of the city that you, that was impossible, but amazing. And out of his journey, there was all these sort of interesting details that would pop up, and it would just sort of remind you of the texture of the city.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're really simple and really small, and it would just be, you know, about plant life in New York City or birds in New York City. And it just reminded me of the sort of the amazing stuff that's sort of right in front of our eyes. And that's kind of what struck with me. And then I somehow convinced Matt to let me film him, of which I then filmed him for 3 years.
You must be good friends.
Yeah.
Did it put a strain on the friendship at all?
No, it didn't.
No.
You know, and it actually, you know, there wasn't really a crew. It was just Jeremy out there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think part of the reason that it worked for Matt was that I was able to say to him, hey, it's just me. You know, it's just me with a camera. There's not going to even be a sound person. And
oh, you didn't have a sound guy?
No.
Good sound for no sound guy.
thank you. So it was just, I let Matt just, you know, was doing his walk, and I just sort of came and followed along. And what he saw, we saw. And the experience that he had of doing this sort of crazy project, we got to sort of kind of embed with him why he does it. It's very unusual.
And it was a really respectful way he did it, which was just, he'll just come around and see what happens. It was never like, oh, can we go over there and get this shot? And like, can you talk to this person? So that just made it really feel natural to me. And I think that's what made it work, that he was just there and just seeing what was happening and, you know, kind of in the same line of thought as I was.
Jesse, when did you hear about this project?
I got an email out of the blue from Jeremy while he was editing. He was looking for some kind of creative input and a person with some kind of, like, you know, public profile to champion it. Mm-hmm. I've been asked kind of to do similar things, you know, in the last few years. I've never gotten involved. It's not what I'm interested in. And so I plan to just, as a polite response, just watch 5 minutes of it and congratulate him on the 5 minutes that I watched, and respectfully decline to work on it. But 5 minutes turned into,
I like that you had that all worked out.
Yeah. I've written the email before, and then, you know, 5 minutes turned into 10 minutes, turned into the movie, and then I watched it again that same day. I just it spoke to me kind of, you know, transcended my own personal interests, and I thought was really about something important to my. What I studied in college was anthropology. I've always been interested in, like, you know, in other cultures within the city. It's my wife's degree too. She teaches in, you know, Title I schools around New York City. So I feel like I've gotten to be exposed to parts of New York City that a lot of people I know haven't been exposed to. And so when I saw somebody like Matt, who's open-minded, who's interested in people, really explore the city with that kind of worldly perspective, I thought this is such a kind of an important statement on what it's like to live in a metropolis.
And you're very respectful. That's the one thing. This could have easily turned into, let's look at that culture from over there.
Right.
Have you always been sort of an open guy like that? Or did you have to learn this along the way?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think maybe it just came with being in New York and just, you know, being curious about what's going on and just kind of wanting to see. And I mean, it's funny, you know, use the word respectful, because I do feel like the whole act of walking in somebody's neighborhood is a very respectful thing. You know, this idea of just taking your free time to go see what other people are up to and how they're living. There's just something in that inherent in that about just, you know, being interested in appreciating what other people do and not judging it. So I guess in that way it was kind of a central part of the walk.
It was amazing when I would be with him filming and I would expect there to be, oh my God, there's going to be some conflict. We're going into this quote unquote bad neighborhood, and just sort of following Matt and watching him go and interact with anybody and instantly sort of become, you know, kind of friendly with them. And somebody compared Matt to a human greeting card. And it was sort of like that. You would just go into these neighborhoods and he would suddenly just, people would meet him and he would tell what he was doing. And like instantly this sort of like world of these communities would just sort of come out to hear what he was doing. And it was fascinating. It was always fascinating just in any place in New York City.
I think you made a wise choice, though, as a filmmaker, to put in a couple of times people not being cool with a camera showing up.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely happened. But what seemed to happen a lot of times was, you know, there would be a camera there. They'd wonder what was going on. And then they would talk to Matt and hear what he was doing. And Matt would explain what his project was. And then instantly, almost like, you know, on a snap, they would just suddenly turn and become, you know, want to walk with them practically. So it was really amazing to see just
mostly out of pity.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what you're doing, Jesus. Okay, film whatever.
Yeah.
No, there is a power in doing something that you can describe really boringly because it makes people think like, okay, no one's going to see this. Like,
right. That brings me to you, Jesse, as a producer. Mm-hmm. Hi, I have a film about a guy walking.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to help give me distribution?
Right.
How did you approach people? How, when you told them about this project, how did you describe it?
Well, I think the movie has like a few things that are like, you know, like accessible from the kind of perspective that you're describing, which is that it shows a side of the most interesting city in the world, but and every street of it. But I think what was really interesting about the reactions to the movie was that, you know, Matt and I are, you know, I'm his, you know, probably movie analog if they were going to make a movie of his life. But, you know, we're very similar. But I think what's really special about this project is that it seems to speak to people in totally different walks of life or people who want different things. When I showed the movie to my parents, you know, they're in their 60s, you know, they felt like they connected with Matt because he seemed like he was more of their generation, you know, rather than, you know, the millennial generation who, for example, would never do anything like this because it has no immediate goal or reward and you can't really documented in any satisfying way, except that we made a documentary about it. But I think, and my wife, who's, you know, an activist, you know, saw Matt's journey as trying to, you know, integrate into a city that has been so stratified. Mm-hmm. And so I think it actually speaks to to people in a really personal way.
We're talking about the movie The World Before Your Feet. It's a documentary. It is directed by Jeremy and produced by Jeremy Workman, directed and written by Jeremy Workman.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Okay, just want to make sure I get it right. Produced by Jesse Eisenberg, and it features Matt Green and his goal of walking all of New York City. Now, how did you organize yourself, given how big this city is? What am I doing today? Where am I going today? How long is it going to take me?
Yeah, an important part of this whole thing for me, budget-wise, is that I don't have an apartment. I don't pay rent. I couch surf. I cat sit. I house sit.
So you live off about $10 a day.
Yeah, I've very limited budget. So I stay in, you know, neighborhoods all over the city. And so I'm basically walking wherever is near me. Mm-hmm. Just practically, that's a good way to do it. And I, you know, in the early days, I could walk out the door where I was staying and walk whatever route I want because it was all, you know, new territory. And then as things start to fill in, you just kind of, it's all just eyeballing on the map, looking at what gaps are left and just trying to connect it together. But it's not any particularly technical way or anything. It's just kind of, you know, I'm here today. This is nearby. I'll go walk it.
Just by way of example, we were around Central Park today, and he said, "Oh, I have a few blocks south of Central Park." We're thinking, like, how could you possibly have blocks south of Central Park that you haven't walked, but yet you've walked every part of the canals and, you know, Rockaway Beach? So he has random pockets of the city that he's yet to finish.
Where so far have you been that you think even the most hardcore New Yorker hasn't been?
I don't know. I mean, not too long ago, I was walking through the Jamaica Bay National Wildlife Refuge, and there's a trail. There's this artificial pond they created there where a lot of birders go, and there's a trail that they opened for 2 months. They lower the water level in the pond, and they have this trail that runs up the side of the pond that's open from, like, you know, August 1st, October 1st. So I go out there, and of course, trail is a very loose definition. It's just like slogging through mud and like walking through reeds and everything. And then I got to like the northern end of that, turn around, went around like where the the subway touches down on the island where Broad Channel is in the middle of Jamaica Bay, like walked around that. So there's so much like shoreline and stuff in New York that you know, even if you've been to everywhere everyone lives in New York, there are all these places that are part of what I'm walking because they're public outdoor spaces, but you know, I don't think anyone goes there.
The name of the film is The World Before Your Feet. We're speaking with the film's director, Jeremy Workman, and producer, Jesse Eisenberg, as well as Matt Green, the fellow who said he was going to walk every street in New York City. We'll be back after a quick break.
Matt started doing a ton of research.
This house, this building, this fence.
He found the thing. He got curious about it. He'd stay up all night reading newspapers from the 1800s.
I sometimes questioned whether it was healthy, all that isolation that he would do with his walk.
I thought it was going to take maybe, you know, 2 to 2.5 years, but that was almost 5 years ago now.
Why do you like to walk?
I felt like it's just the perfect way to kind of explore the world.
Touchdown!
Good to meet you all. Matt. See where this ends up taking me. When you meet a person, you become much more interested in them.
Come in.
I think it's the same thing with, you know, a city.
Whoa.
It's an actual place where you stood and you felt something there.
You know what used to be right over here?
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we are back with the filmmakers behind the documentary, The World Before Your Feet. That's Jeremy Workman, who's the director, and Jesse Eisenberg, who is the producer. Matt Green is the subject, and Matt decided he was going to walk every single street in New York City in all five boroughs. I'm wondering, you said you survived about $10, $15 a day. As you were walking through neighborhoods like awesome bakeries, or you know it's like the most amazing cannoli, did you treat yourself? Did you have?
I didn't. I don't have the funds for it, you know.
Wow, that's just some willpower,
it's
my friend.
One of the, you know, it's like once you've given up for a while, you lose the urge for it. So,
Jeremy, you include some of Matt's friends and mm-hmm. former girlfriends. Why did you want to take us away from the walking for a while?
Yeah, you know, I wanted, as much as this is a story about New York City, as much as a story about this sort of, you know, incredible quest that Matt's doing, it's also a story about this kind of interesting yet eccentric guy. And I think when you watch it, you're constantly asking yourself, you know, why does this guy who had this great job, you know, he was an engineer, why did he want to drop that and now live a life of $10 a day and not eat cannolis and, you know, sleep on people's couches across the city? Why was he interested in that? So, you know, it the documentary digs into a little bit about Matt's background and gets into how he's sort of, you know, his friendships, his ex-girlfriends, and kind of gets a little deeper into what sort of makes him tick. And I still don't know if we find out what makes Matt tick, but you know, it at least we sort of get a better sense of it and a better sense of the bigger picture of what drives him to go walk every day.
Jesse, I'm curious what your wife thinks as someone who studied anthropology when she saw the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think she works in like 150 Title I schools in the five boroughs, and my best friend has been a teacher for incarcerated kids throughout the city. And so when they saw the movie, they I think they were less surprised by seeing parts of the city that they've been exposed to that probably most people haven't if you work like in media, for example. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of the really interesting things by way of example is that, you know, Matt is in Brownsville and finds like the first, what would have been the first
birth control
mm-hmm. center.
And it's got graffiti around it. Yeah, and there's
forgotten.
Nothing special about it. It's
totally forgotten.
Right. Where Margaret Sanger was.
That's right. And, you know, and so if you and so like and I think probably if you dig into any kind of metropolis, you're going to find stuff like this, you know. But what she really loved was the way Matt dealt with other people. You know, it's funny because he seems like a urban guy because of the way he moves and everything. But actually, he's from a small town in Virginia, and I think he has those values when he approaches people. And his defenses are not up. You know, if you grow up in New York City, you get a heightened sense of, you know, paranoia. Mm-hmm. Just you know, and he doesn't have that, and so he has this really wonderful quality. And you know, when you study anthropology, the first thing you don't want to put your footprint down because you don't want to affect, you know, what the thing. And he really doesn't do that. He integrates seamlessly in every group.
It seemed like right when I started filming, Matt, it seemed like, wow, this was a story about a guy walking around a small town. And it's such a weird way to think about New York City. It's the biggest city in the United States by far. But when you walk with him and when you watch him in all these different neighborhoods, it really does seem like that. It seems like it's about a guy walking around a small town and interacting with the people and sort of seeing all the history come alive that's in that town. Yet it happens to be New York City, this giant metropolis.
You don't ignore race in the documentary in a very one way, very explicit, and also I think rather subtly. The explicit way is, Matt, you meet another walker, a fellow travelman, and he's African American.
Yeah, he's from Jamaica.
Yeah, and he talks about the way he has been received on some of his walks, or what he does as preventative measures, so he isn't received as an angry black man. Although, if you saw this guy, I mean, I look at him, I'm like, nerd.
Yeah.
And I mean that in the nicest way.
Although that's a part of his strategy. You know,
yeah, well, it worked. Like a nerd. What did you think when you heard how he has to do this?
Yeah, I mean, the day that I met him, we you know, just immediately started comparing notes about walking around New York. And you know, there aren't a lot of people who just spend huge amounts of their time wandering through different neighborhoods. So I haven't had the chance to talk to many people with different perspectives on it. And the few that I'd known before were all white men. And so, you know, to hear his stories was really eye-opening to me about, you know, the experiences he had had in other neighborhoods that were, you know, those experiences were so foreign to me. And yeah, it was really, you know, we're certainly aware at this moment in time of lots of ways in which it's different to be different races out in the public sphere. But to have someone who's really doing such a similar activity to me and hearing those differences was really eye-opening. And it just moved it from beyond the realm of like, oh, I bet it would be harder if I wasn't white, to like, what is it actually like? I now have a guy who's telling me these stories about what happened to him. And it just makes it a lot more real and a lot more imaginable for me, you know, when I can understand his perspective and hear how things were different for him.
What was it like for you when you went into the neighborhood and you were the minority?
You know, honestly, when I first moved to New York, before I, you know, when I was working as an engineer and started this, we had, you know, we had a lot of projects we were working on in the South Bronx. And so those were kind of my first experiences of, you know, being some part of New York where I was a minority. And, you know, you're very aware of it at first, and then it gradually goes away. And at this point, you know, it doesn't really feel weird anymore. But it's also like, you know, I'm certainly aware when people, I can tell when people are looking at me differently, mm-hmm. but I also just try to behave, you know, in the world that I want to exist, where I pretend like they're not looking at me differently. And, you know, that makes a big difference when you just act like you belong somewhere. And so that's always my strategy, just like, you know, pretend we're all the same, because that's what I'd hope would be the world. And it seems to work pretty well.
The name of the documentary is The World Before Your Feet. We're talking with the filmmakers and the subject of the film, Matt Green, who is
walking, still walking, a little bit left, seventh year
of walking through New York City. Oh my goodness. When you say it out loud, you think about like,
it's a lot of streets.
It's a lot of streets. It's a lot of commitment. So you've been living this lifestyle of this couch surfing, $10 a day for 7 years now.
Yeah, really. It was over 9 years ago now that I quit my job and I started my cross-country walk. And I just worked some odd jobs in between that and this. So it's been over 9 years since I had an apartment.
Do you think you can kind of reintegrate when you're finished, or are you just going to pick another city?
I don't know. I don't know what I'll do next. I honestly have no idea. Yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah, besides just the walking, Matt does all this sort of research on everything he sees. So it becomes this really kind of long, you know, view of the entire city, because it's not just the physical walking. It's also now he follows it up with, when he sees something that sort of catches his eye, all this sort of research on it.
That point that you made about the first birth control clinic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You found that. What other interesting tidbits have you found that surprised you?
Oh, man. I mean, it's endless. I couldn't even remember.
Give two.
How.
Just two.
Give two.
Well, what in the film, there's a couple moments in the film where Matt points out trees. And one of the things that I know a lot of people are really blown away are the redwoods in New York City.
Yeah, there's a big, I don't know how tall it is, 90 feet or something, redwood on Houston Street, a dawn redwood, which, you know, I had passed by a million times without ever seeing it somehow. And then I was just walking through Brooklyn and in Midwood, and I saw this giant beautiful tree, and I took a lot of pictures and I figured out what it was, and I found out it was this dawn redwood, which was this type of tree that was thought to be extinct, and then like the 1940s I think some were discovered in central China and kind of repropagated out around the world. And then once I saw it, you know, that's kind of a recurring thing for me. Once you notice something, you start noticing it everywhere.
Sure.
Else, and I started realizing there are these redwood trees all over New York, including this giant one on Houston Street that towers over the other trees there that I'd never noticed before.
As you started becoming self-educated, and did you think, God, I got to go back to other places that I was before because maybe I missed something?
Yeah, that's a constant urge of like knowing, you know, I mean, I'll walk a second time, or I'll cross an intersection that I walked years ago, and I'll just see a whole world of things that I never noticed the first time. It just makes me wonder what I didn't notice years ago and what I'm not noticing now. And I've just had to kind of surrender to the idea that you can't see all of New York City by being everywhere once, you know? And that's part of the beauty of the city. So it doesn't get to me anymore, but I definitely feel that urge to like go back and look a little more carefully.
Okay, you guys as filmmakers, you have a lot of footage of a dude walking.
500 hours, maybe more.
And walking.
Yeah.
And walking. What is your editing process? How did you create your story arc?
Right. That was the biggest challenge of this movie because, you know, this isn't a movie where, you know, it's ticking off the mileage and you're trying to figure out, will Matt finish? Will he do it? You know, crossing off each neighborhood. It's not that movie at all. It's a movie about sort of being with this person and on this journey that sounds kind of goofy at first, maybe even silly, maybe even a waste of time. And then over the course of the movie, it sort of starts getting a little deeper and deeper. And as the movie goes, it suddenly starts showing new possibilities and new dimensions. And you start sort of discovering something from his walk. So that was kind of how I thought about editing it. It was a very difficult job. It was over, like I said, over 500 hours of footage, which I shot over 3 years. And sort of constructing that into something that would be audience friendly, that would be something for people to enjoy, not just New Yorkers, but really anyone. In a way, it's not even for New Yorkers, it's for just really could be anyone. It was definitely a big challenge. It took me 2 years to edit, and I was editing it as I was shooting it. So it's sort of, I had this kind of more organic way to do it. You know, I didn't just shoot it and then go sit and edit it. I did it all at the same time, and it allowed me to really you know, get into the mindset of what Matt's project was about and what stood out for me.
How did you know it was your last day? How did you go, this is it, this is the day?
We premiered at a big film festival in the spring, South by Southwest, and we shot 2 weeks before the premiere, and we had to pick up a couple shots, and we said, we better get those in before the premiere. And we shot, like I said, about 2 weeks before the movie premiered. And then that sort of led this journey of this movie where it had been playing at a lot of film festivals around the country and really getting a lot of attention from audiences. And then sort of now is coming home for its release here in New York and also in L.A.
I meant actually when you were out filming with him.
Yeah.
When was did you go back in and re-edit as during the film festival process?
No.
Okay, so I mean the day that you were with Matt, or the week you were with Matt, and you said, this is going to be my last week.
We had a date when the movie was going to premiere, and I said, okay, well, we better finish by that.
So you did have a drop dead date.
You also had a drone for a few days.
I did.
For a day.
I did.
I know. I noticed the drone shots. I was like, nice.
Yeah, yeah. There was a couple days that I didn't shoot. One was the drone shot. Or I didn't shoot, you know, I wasn't holding the camera. One was a day where we had a lot of drones and we filmed Matt sort of amid the city with drone shots. And, you know, that was definitely something where we wanted to sort of see Matt in this crazy metropolis, you know, this giant world. So that was a big deal. And then we also shot... there's this map in the Queens Museum called the Panorama that was built for the World's Fair, and it's this giant, giant model of New York City. There's like about a million buildings on it, you know, like the Empire State Building's maybe like 6 inches or so. And we filmed that with a giant 50-foot technocrane to give you a sense of, you know, the idea that you're like flying over the city as you're following along with Matt. And that people could see. It's at the Queens Museum. It's really amazing.
Jesse, how do you look at New York differently now after being a part of this project?
You know, when I first moved here, because I grew up between Queens and New Jersey, when I first moved into Manhattan, I did a lot of urban exploration. I snuck down to the tunnels on 122nd Street, those old abandoned train tunnels, and, you know, did all the things that a curious kind of kid does. But I always kind of, I never gave it any kind of credence. I never thought it was... you know, culturally relevant. It was just something to do to sneak into somewhere. And when I saw the movie and now that I know Matt, it's like it almost gives me permission to appreciate that kind of stuff. I think we all have a kind of probably nagging curiosity because if we live in the city, you know, of what other places in it look like, but we so rarely find out just because other things get in the way. And I think what he gives permission with his journey is for regular people, you know, who are not going to do the journey to the extent that he's doing, to kind of explore the city that they live in. I mean, he makes the point that if you live on 16th Street, you're probably never going to see 17th Street because you would have no reason to go to that street. And I think, you know, Matt gives permission to go look at 17th Street, and it's a kind of small, you know, it's a small thing that could make a big difference.
You know, when I was broke in New York when I first got here, and you'd get vacation for because I had a job. I was lucky enough to have a job. I'd say, people say, are you going someplace? I say, I'm going to New York for vacation. And I would pick a neighborhood and just spend my day in that neighborhood because you can't get a sense of a place unless you're on the ground. Mm-hmm. You really can't.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in New York, there's just, I mean, there's a whole world in the city. So, you know, you could spend your whole life going to different neighborhoods and constantly seeing new stuff.
I was shocked how many neighborhoods were in New York City. I mean, it was just endless. You know, you go out to like East Queens and, you know, parts of Brooklyn, and there's just so many neighborhoods. And it just reminds you like how big this city is and how many different stories are sort of embedded in it. It's crazy. I had lived in New York for years and years, but really, like a lot of people, my context was just sort of a small little sort of footprint, you know, in New York City. And when you sort of realize how big it is, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Well, everybody can go on the journey with Matt. The name of the film is The World Before Your Feet. Matt Green, Jeremy Walkman, and Jesse Eisenberg, thank you so much for coming in the studio to all of it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and our next segment is for grown-ups only. If you know you can't talk politics at the holiday get-together, here's another issue you can put out there. Sex, or lack of sex. That's the grown-up only's part. The cover story of this month's issue of The Atlantic says that young Americans are having less sex than ever. It's something that's happening, or not happening, worldwide. That's right, in spite of changing social attitudes towards sex and the widespread popularity of hookup apps like Tinder, young Americans are in the midst of what the article calls a sex recession. Here to talk about the millennial sex drought is Kate Julian. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and her article is in the December issue. It's the cover, actually, called Why Are Young People Having So Little Sex? Hi, Kate.
Hi.
And listeners, we would like to hear from you. Are you a member of the relevant demographic that is under the age of 35? Give us a call. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or perhaps you're a sex therapist who has seen evidence of this sex recession. 212-433-9692. Or maybe you're a member of a different generation. Say boomers were looking at you and you want to offer your take on the changing sexual landscape. And just a reminder, everybody calling in, stay on topic, please. All right, Kate, what was your first bit of evidence that you saw pointing towards a sex recession?
So over the last few years, a number of studies have come out in one of the leading sex research journals, led by a researcher from California named Jean Twenge. And she's looked at the fact that young adults are starting their sex lives later. This has been something that's been developing for years. And she also looked at the sexual frequency of people who are in their 20s, that is, how often they were having sex, and of older adults as well. And finally, she looked at how many people were celibate and found that about 2.5 times as many 20-somethings are celibate now as compared to past generational groups. And I thought that that was really fascinating and counterintuitive for all the reasons that you just rattled off. So I wanted to know more.
So, I mean, with all the hookup apps like Tinder and the classic text of you up for that late night call, sex is easier to find than ever. So what are some of the reasons young people are having less of it?
So there seem to be several things going on at once here. The first, which is sort of obvious, is that most people under 35 are now living without a partner. And more people in that age group than are living with a parent than in any other living arrangement.
Oh, and that's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not going on a limb to say that living with your parents for most of us probably wouldn't be great for your sex life. but going from there, the question is, so why are people less likely to be living with a partner? And economics is obviously a huge part of that, but there seem to be some other things going on as well. For starters, it appears that people may be coming into their 20s with less romantic experience on average than previous groups may have had. That may lead sort of getting into romantic relationships in your 20s to be more difficult. Digital distraction is obviously a big part of this. Porn is part of that, but maybe not in the way that you'd think. It seems like learning about sex from porn is having some real downsides for some people. Last two things quickly, dating apps, which as you mentioned, seem like they would make things easier. And for some people, they clearly do. But for a whole other group of people, they seem to be really inefficient and pretty demoralizing. And then lastly, depression, anxiety, poor self-image, all of these are things that 20-somethings seem to be struggling with, especially all of them are known libido killers.
I want to ask about a couple of different things. First of all, is this sex drought affecting young gay and lesbians in the same way it's taken hold among straight folks?
This is such a fascinating question, and I wish there were more research on it. The fact is that there just isn't a lot of research on non-heterosexual dating and sexual experience. There is one researcher at Stanford who's looked at this to some extent by trying to oversample gay and lesbians in his sort of long-running major study, How Couples Meet and Stay Together. And he found that gay and lesbian identified people were dating more more actively than straight identified people, which I think is really fascinating and does, to me, raise the sort of intriguing possibility that part of what's going on may be kind of a straight phenomenon.
And what about race and class?
So here there are a couple of interesting things to note. The research that Jean Twenge did on sexual frequency, how frequently people were having sex, found that this applied to pretty much every demographic group she could sort of isolate. Men, women, across races, across regions, northeast, southwest, across working status. And that's really fascinating because there aren't very many trends that sort of apply across the board. When we're looking at adolescents specifically, it seems that there's been an especially big change relatively quickly among African Americans who are really delaying their sexual onset even more than other groups are. And that's fascinating, but it's not something that I had got into in the article.
Kate Julian is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her piece is called Why Are Young People Having So Little Sex? This is not just an American phenomenon. This is happening globally. And in Japan, it's been particularly intense. It's really interesting what you wrote. Can you explain to folks what's been happening in Japan?
Yeah, so for the better part of 10 years, people in Japan have been talking about what they call celibacy syndrome as a problem. The age of sort of first intercourse has gone way up there. The number of people who are totally sexually inexperienced in adulthood has gone way up. And this has coincided, of course, with some really big changes there in terms of the job market and the economy, and even more so than here, more people are living at home. But interestingly, sort of this is led to this sort of whole different, this whole sort of taxonomy of sort of sexlessness, I call it in the article. Mm-hmm. So young men who prefer not to have sex are known as grass-eating men. And as I say in the article, what's really interesting to me is the extent to which this has coincided there not only with real sort of flourishing and flowering of porn as an industry, but really also an increasing emphasis on masturbation as a way to sort of fulfill yourself sexually, and a whole bunch of products and services that are designed to make masturbation more enjoyable.
All right, we want to take a call if you don't mind. This is Naruto. He's calling from New Hampshire, but he used to live in New York. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. So I just wanted to kind of like give my opinion on this, because I was listening to what you guys were saying, and I definitely agree with a lot of it. But I used to live in New York City, and now I live in Exeter, New Hampshire. And, like, it's very different in terms of, like, the hookup culture in New York and in Exeter, but a lot of it is the same. And I don't know if I would necessarily agree with, like, how the teens are not hooking up as much as they used to with the baby boomers. But it's just, like, I feel like it's very prevalent in our age group. Mm-hmm. I think, especially because I go to boarding school, and it's a very big hookup culture, especially in boarding school. So I don't know if I would necessarily agree with what you guys were saying.
That's interesting, considering how you're spending your time in a place away from home. Again, if you want to join the conversation, 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. That's an interesting case, because not all kids go to boarding school, and also a Tony boarding school, like. Probably Andover is where he is.
Yeah. So I would say to that, definitely hookup culture is alive and well. There's no question about that. But I think a lot of adults who are older misunderstand what the term hookup means. It's a really flexible and elastic term. And research is pretty clear, as my interviews were, about the fact that it can mean kind of anything that you want it to. So I think that the notion that people who are engaging in hookup culture are all necessarily having sex with each other all the time is not correct. And furthermore, it seems that although hookup culture is prevalent on college campuses, and I would say also on boarding school campuses, not everybody's participating in it. So we have this sort of situation where definitely that's a big part of life, but it's also really prominent and really visible, and people sort of think about what they see, and they don't think about the people who are staying home and not participating in it.
Also, I misspoke. There's Andover, and then there's Phillips Exeter, which is probably what he was talking about in terms of boarding school. Right. I want to go back to some of the digital distractions and apps and dating apps. You know, it's so funny. Back in the day when I was, went on one of those websites, I used to call it boyfriend shopping. Because you would go on and you would just, you know, scroll through. And one of the parts of your article that you mentioned is that people are spending more time on these apps but not having satisfaction.
So some people are having satisfaction. I absolutely want to be clear about that.
Okay.
Apps have become, you know, over 10 years, the most common way that people meet by some measures. So that's huge. For a lot of people, they obviously are working. People who meet via apps are more likely to get married more quickly than people who meet other ways. Like, clearly it's working for them. The problem is that for other people, they can be just this tremendous time suck. The last time Tinder released data about this, they found that the average user was spending like an hour and a half a day on the app. And that's just a ton of time. And I had just interview after interview after interview with people who were having bad experiences. You know, one man who did ultimately find a relationship, a long-term relationship via an app, came out of a previous long-term relationship in 2014, having been in this long-term relationship for 7 years. So before apps to after apps. And he was really startled when he came out of them, out of the relationship rather, by just like how different dating culture seemed become over that time period. He sort of described it as stepping out of a time machine. And he found that, you know, it really was sort of a full-time job. He figured, as somebody who wasn't super physical attractive by his own description, that he was like swiping right like 300 times for every woman that he actually had a text exchange with, which was wild to me as a pre-dating app person.
And also just what that would do to your self-esteem. I mean, that could just turn you off dating altogether.
It really could. And I think that particularly for people who aren't super physically attractive or who don't photograph wonderfully, it can be really tough. One recent study that came out found that people in general tend to shoot for people who are like 25% more attractive than they are, which is fascinating, you know, because then you realize this is clearly not a recipe for success if everybody is doing that.
We're speaking with Kate Julian, as a senior editor at The Atlantic. The name of her piece is Why Are Young People Having So Little Sex? How much of this has to do with intimacy and the lack of intimacy? You mentioned earlier on in the interview about people almost not getting that those adolescent heartbreaks and that adolescent experience you need to emotionally evolve.
I think that's right. I mean, there's been a sort of dearth of research really on adolescence that's really looking at it as a qualitative experience. Like, a lot of the research to date has been much more about numbers and public health outcomes. Do they get pregnant? Do they have diseases and so forth? But there does seem to be an emerging body of research that's looking at sort of the importance of all kinds of relationships in adolescence to the people that we become as adults. And clearly, it's really an important sort of time for practicing and experimentation and self-discovery. And it's not to say that if you don't have that, you won't come into adulthood and have fabulous relationships. But for some people, it may be more difficult. And a number of researchers that I talked to who are looking at adolescence really focused on that theme.
What about the cultural shift? The idea that people don't really talk to each other anymore. They text, they meet each other online. I mean, you used to go out and you'd go to a bar and maybe you saw somebody cute and you talked to them.
So, yeah, I mean, clearly some people are still meeting in person. I've heard since this piece came out, you know, a lot of people confirming that this is their sense of things as well. But I've also heard some great meet cute stories from people who did meet in bars or on subways. So, you know, if people can respond in some way to this article by going out and like talking to people in real life, I would love that. I do think, though, that it does seem that when we're on our phones, it just becomes less acceptable to strike up conversations. It seems weird in a way that it didn't fairly recently.
You spoke to many experts who say another aspect of the sex recession is that women are avoiding bad sex that they don't want to have.
This was one of the things I found most troubling and really most surprising, is the extent of painful sex and sexual dysfunction among women and among young people generally. One major recent study found that 30% of women reported having pain the last time they had vaginal intercourse. And for anal sex, the rate was above 70%. Those are really striking numbers. And what I found even more concerning is that most people don't tell their partner about it. A couple of researchers I talked to really said that they think a lot of young women may not even know that this is something that they should expect to be otherwise. And that's deeply troubling.
Let's go to Nina, who is on line. Where are you? Nina, you're calling from New Jersey. Hi, Nina.
Hi. I'm sorry, but like I'm going to have to correct you. My name is Nina.
Nina. Okay.
With an M.
Nina, what did you want to say?
So I just wanted to say, like, being a millennial myself, like, we are just so exhausted with everything. Like, you have to work so much. You have to pay for your college. You have to do this and that and be socially active. And by the time you get around to having sex, you're just tired. And Tinder and all these dating apps, they're exhausting. It's so robotic to keep swiping. Like, everything about having sex is so exhausting.
Mina, thank you so much for weighing in on that. Let's go to Ben on the Lower East Side, line two. Hi, Ben.
Hi there. Yeah, so I wanted to add that I don't know if, like, the lack of sex is necessarily true, but I would say that a lot of the intimacy has been taken out of it through social media, mostly like the experience of it and the realness of it and the naturalness of it. Through things like Tinder, you know what you're on there for, and it takes the you know, love aspect and intimate aspect out of it. Or if you go on Instagram, you know everything about that person already, and it just kind of defeats this natural progression of a relationship for a lot of young people, and I think that can be demoralizing.
Ben, thanks for weighing in. Does what Ben says make sense?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, I think also there's this question of whether we know what we're looking for. And some people I talked to about dating apps focused on this, the idea that we might be looking for something that isn't ultimately the thing that would make us happy, and that the way we get to know people on apps is just different than the way we get to know people in real life, where we might have more cues about sort of the person's kindness or funniness or what have you. I thought the previous caller's note about exhaustion was really key. Mm-hmm. And this is something that comes up in the Japanese context, where people talk about, there's a word that they use for the idea that sex is too tiresome. And I think that if you're working two jobs and you're financially stretched and you're spending a lot of time online doing this and that, it can be sort of overwhelming to think about doing something that really requires being in the moment and mindful in the way that the way that sort of true intimacy does. And I don't just mean physical intimacy, emotional intimacy.
What are some of the societal implications that a sex recession might have? We've got about a minute left.
Yes. So a lot of people will go straight to the birth rate declining. And it is true that the U.S. birth rate hit a historic low for a second year running last year. Honestly, I'm much less concerned about that than I am what this says about happiness. We know that sexual functioning really is like a great barometer of human happiness and flourishing. It doesn't mean that you have to be sexually active to have a good life, but if you are having a good sex life, it's a pretty good indication that the rest of your life is going well. And so if something is going on in our culture that's making the conditions for that more elusive and more fraught, that strikes me as something that we might want to consider as a bit of a wake-up call.
It's a great read, really interesting. Why are young people having so little sex? Kate Julian from The Atlantic, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to all of it on WNYC. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.